Welcome to WMFA, a podcast about why and how we write. I'm Courtney Ballastier, and this week I'm speaking with Heather Clark, whose recent biography, Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath, is now out in paperback.
I really wanted to try to rewrite that script. I did not want her name to be synonymous with madness and tragedy. I wanted her name to be synonymous with an amazingly prolific, ambitious, talented professional writer.
Heather earned her bachelor's degree in English literature from Harvard University and her doctorate in English from Oxford University. Her awards include a National Endowment for the Humanities Public Scholar Fellowship, a Leon Levy Biography Fellowship at the City University of New York, and a visiting U.S. fellowship at the Eccles Center for American Studies, British Library. A former visiting scholar at the Oxford Center for Life Writing, she is also the author of The Grief of Influence, Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, and The Ulster Renaissance, Poetry in Belfast, 1962 to 1972. Her work has appeared in publications including Harvard Review, Times Literary Supplement, Time, Airmail, and LitHub, and she recently served as the scholarly consultant for the BBC documentary Sylvia Plath, Life Inside the Bell Jar. She divides her time between Chappaqua, New York, and Yorkshire, England, where she is a professor of contemporary poetry at the University of Huddersfield.
The very simple question that I had in my head was, how did Sylvia Plath become the writer that she became? And that was just the question that guided the whole book, really.
Red Comet is a defiantly large work, an exhaustive study of the life of a poet who is often reduced to the terms of her death. We talk here about how Heather sought to add context to that shorthand version of Plath, which pathologizes and fetishizes her because of her suicide at the age of 30. Heather says she wanted to write about the life of an artist, and what is abundantly clear in Red Comet is that Plath was a serious artist and a serious craftsperson her entire life. Reaching back into Plath's juvenilia, including unpublished stories and poems from her youth, Heather crafts a portrait of a fiercely talented and driven artist. I came to Red Comet not because of a deep appreciation of Plath, though I left with that. Rather, I picked it up because I have an omnivorous appetite for biographies of women artists. And that, emphatically, is what Heather has written. Immediately, I was confronted with assumptions I hadn't realized I had formed about Sylvia Plath. That she was frivolous and unserious, full of histrionics, a phase for girls who tended toward the maudlin. This internalized misogyny is by no means uncommon in literature, but it dogged me more the more that I read Plath's work, which, no big revelation from me here, is often exquisite and precise. Heather offers an intimate look at Plath's commitment to and passion for her art, as well as the contradictions and complications that made her the artist and the person that she was. Here, we talk about the years-long work of such a massive project, permissions, archives, organizing research, and about charting Plath's growth as a person and a creative. At WMFA's Patreon page, we talk about making writing joyful and how the joy that Heather found in the process of Red Comet informed the book's flow. You can hear this and other bonus segments by visiting patreon.com/WMFA podcast and pledging just $2 a month. One of the things that I wanted to start with was I picked up this book not necessarily out of a kind of pre-existing interest in Sylvia Plath, but just because I really love reading biographies of creative women. And I was really fascinated with like how kind of deeply I fell for her, which I think is really a testament to your writing, but also to the point that you're trying to make with the book. You know, what you talk about in the prologue, that she has kind of been reduced in this way, kind of whether it's reduced to her suicide or reduced to, you know, some kind of sort of, you know, girlish sort of attitude, like things like the bell jar, that we kind of don't take her seriously as an artist and as a writer. And then I was really fascinated to find, when I listened to your interview on the Slate podcast Working, that you hadn't particularly been interested in her either when you found her. So I would love to start by just talking about how you came to her and kind of what motivated, you know, I know such a long course of, such a long project doesn't necessarily, you know, if we knew how long these things would take from the outset, we probably wouldn't start. But what, yes. what kind of was the abide, like what kept you coming back to her, do you think?
Yeah, it's so true that if we had If we had known, right, when we start out on these huge projects, I don't. I mean, you have to start out with a bit of naivete, I think, and profound and bottomless optimism, because that's what is going to see you through writing a 500-page biography or an 1,100-page biography.
I was gonna say,
but yeah, I started becoming interested in Sylvia Plath in graduate school. I was getting a PhD and I was writing about Northern Irish poets in Belfast in the 70s, which is, you know, a far cry from Sylvia Plath, right? But through the work of these Northern Irish poets, I actually came to know of Ted Hughes's work on a much more sophisticated level, because the Irish poet Seamus Heaney was best friends with Ted Hughes. So I came to Sylvia Plath sort of through this back door of male Northern Irish poets. And the more I started reading about Plath and Hughes and their marriage, I became very interested in their literary relationship and just the fact that these two, you know, two of the greatest poets of the post-war generation were married to each other. And, you know, I was so interested intellectually about that, like that question, what did it mean for their poetry and what did that mean for Anglo-American poetry in general? So when I was in graduate school, I was asked to teach some tutorials on Sylvia Plath, and that solidified my interest because I overprepared for these classes because I felt like I didn't know enough about Sylvia Plath. And I actually felt like I had sort of fallen for this myth of Plath as, you know, all the doom and gloom and the focus on the suicide and the mental illness and the depression. And once I started reading her poetry seriously and from a kind of more removed angle, I felt like I'd been sold a bill of goods in America. I mean, I was teaching her poetry in England, and I felt like the English attitude was very different to Plath there. There just wasn't the same focus on the pathology and the life story, in a sense. And I just felt like in England, where I was in graduate school, there was just more respect for her as a poet. In the back of my mind for many years, I had been toying with the idea of writing a Plath biography because I didn't think that any of the existing ones were satisfactory. And there wasn't a big biography of Plath, you know, in the way that we have the big biography of Virginia Woolf by Hermione Lee. And I just felt like there was room for the big biography. And also I knew there was a lot of new material that was going to be open to the public soon or published soon. Or, I mean, there were just reams of new letters and there were new archives. And so it just seemed like the right time, you know, and 50 years had gone by since her death, about 50 years, give or take, when I wrote up my proposal. So it just, the whole story was sort of less raw and the permission situation was a little bit easier to navigate. So all of these things, I considered all of them and I decided to go for it. So that's sort of the long, complicated answer to your very, very simple question. So sorry about the rambling.
No, we love long, complicated answers here. There's no problem with that. You know, I thought a lot while I was reading this and while I was getting ready to talk to you about that Clara Vaye Watkins essay on pandering, about how women writers kind of internalize like male, like white hetero male conceptions of literature and what is literary. And because I do think that, like, without realizing it, I had kind of taken this posture toward her that, like, it was kind of embarrassing to like Sylvia Plath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what I wanted to change. That made me furious. This idea that, oh my God, how can one be embarrassed? She's one of the greatest poets of the 20th century.
She's astonishing. Yeah. And yeah. Reading yes. it in context. And then of course I went down the rabbit hole as we do and was just like, no, she's astonishing. Yeah. And I do, you know, I remember, and I had forgotten all about this. I'm sure people say things like this to you all the time when you have these conversations about
about writing this, but I my very first introduction to her was, and I don't know how I came across Lady Lazarus, but it like exploded my brain. And this was like when I was like, you know, 19 maybe. And then I kind of knew about the bell jar, but you know, I think that like this is a really important task that you've done for this reason that, you know, we, the rest of kind of literary America, like guys get to talk, you know, everybody gets Catcher in the Rye. Everybody gets to have these sorts of male counterparts of this, but when it's women, it's, you know, and I want to talk much more, you know, as we go on about this idea of being confessional and this sort of like, auto, you know, well, not auto fiction in this case, but you know, the arguments that we're still having about like, is it, do women authors have the capacity to invent things and, you know, have authorial personas? Imagine that.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, because we love to get into craft here. And I think that you are maybe the first biographer that I've talked to. So even when you talk about things like permissions, like, can you just, can you, for those of us who like are not as much deep in that world, like what was changing and how does that stuff work for you? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You don't need permission from a literary estate to write a biography of that particular author. But it helps enormously because it helps to know from the get-go if you're going to have permission to quote the author's work, for example. If you're writing about a poet, you know, that's particularly important. You want to be able to quote the lines of their poetry, and of course you want to quote from letters and manuscripts and unpublished drafts of stories and poems. So for me, and I'm somebody who likes to quote a lot in my critical work, and especially in this biography of Plath, because I really wanted to center Plath's voice as much as I could. Previous Plath biographers have had a very difficult time getting permission to quote Plath, partly because in the past, the Plath estate was controlled by, Ted Hughes, but Ted Hughes's sister Olwen was sort of the gatekeeper.
And as you write about here, they were not fans of each other by any stretch.
Yeah. So that Olwen and Sylvia had a really complicated relationship, to say the least. And I think Olwen felt like she was protecting Ted Hughes from feminists who were, she felt they were out to destroy him. So it was just, it was a mess. There were a lot of emotions at stake. I think feminist biographers especially had a really hard time with Olwen. And now the Plath estate has passed to Frieda Hughes, the daughter of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. And Frieda is the one who allowed all of her mother's letters, surviving letters, I should say, to be published in 2018.
Mm-hmm. Including the letters to her psychiatrist,
exactly,
right?
Yes, yeah. Including the letters to her psychiatrist, which I think are the most vulnerable and honest letters that she ever wrote, really. Frieda Hughes has been, I think, more proactive about, you know, just getting the story out there and allowing us to read her mother's wonderful letters. And I don't think that was an easy thing for her to do. So I think she has a lot of courage. But I should backtrack and just say, you know, again, you don't need an estate's permission. You can go ahead and write a biography. But sometimes publishers really want that permission up front from the estate so that they know they're not going to have any legal problems down the line. So it's really something you need to negotiate with your editor, with the publisher, with the estate. It's complicated. It's something that novelists don't have to deal with, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I would love to talk a little bit about, I mean, that relationship and what you alluded to just now, that Ted Hughes did for so long, and the Hughes family had this final authority over what was available, and you know, he edited the collection pretty. Like Ariel, initially he edited a little maybe more tightly and not necessarily perhaps the way that she had intended it.
Yeah, that was very controversial, of course, when he changed the order. Yeah.
And I'm curious how, how or even if it's important to you to kind of come down on a personal judgment for yourself as you're working on this, like, I assume that you need to feel that you understand what's happening, but like, do you, you know, do you feel like you've kind of made a decision? Like, do you have a mental, like, okay, well, I've decided Ted Hughes is like this, you know, is unfairly maligned, or gets, you know, gets the criticism he deserves, or doesn't get enough criticism. Like, do you try to keep yourself away from making assessments like that? Or do you feel like it's kind of central to being able to tell the story?
It's, you know, I tried to go where the evidence would lead me in that sense. I mean, I did start the book with a sense of anger and a sense of injustice, I think, on Plath's behalf, that she had become almost this cliche of the hysterical woman writer. And I really wanted to try to rewrite that script. I did not want her name to be synonymous with madness and tragedy. I wanted her name to be synonymous with an amazingly prolific, ambitious, talented professional writer. And I did have that kind of framework in mind, but when I started out, but the only other kind of decision that I made in terms of it, I think in the kind of decision that you're talking about in that way, was I really did not want to blame one particular person for Sylvia Plath's suicide. So even before I started this book, I just decided I wasn't going to do that. And which, you know, which doesn't mean that there were moments when I was really angry about what happened in their marriage and the way she was treated, especially at the end. I just could not put that on someone, whether it was Ted Hughes or Sylvia Plath's mother, Aurelia, who's often also been kind of blamed, because I just think depression is more complicated than that. And in that sense, I didn't quite want to go there. And I know, you know, other Plath scholars probably, you know, would and have, and but, you know, it was a very complicated marriage, and they were both very tempestuous, dramatic people as well, and kind of lived for poetry. You know, tried to sacrifice their lives. I don't mean literally sacrificed her life. I'm not talking about her suicide, but they lived their lives in pursuit of their writing. I mean, that was just their number one priority was their writing, and everything else could go to hell, basically.
Right. Right. Well, and, you know, I think, you know, what you're saying kind of as like the sort of biographers to, or like a task of the biographer, makes perfect sense to me. And I think that, like, you know, I feel like part of why I enjoy reading biographies, this is maybe like too much insight into my own like emotional shortcomings, but like everything's happened, right? So like this life is over. And so there's a sense, like some part of my anxious brain lets me relax with that information, like it's all taken care of or something. And I think, you know, that probably also lends itself to this real desire to oversimplify and to be like, okay, well, here's the story. It's XYZ. And what you're talking about is kind of reminding, you know, just as in, you know, a work of fiction can end in a very messy, unclear fashion, like life, let's not forget that life happens that way too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There can be ambiguity still. There are so many loose ends that you don't necessarily want to, you can't wrap up in a biography. I mean, there's still so many things that I don't know and I wish I knew. And Sylvia Plath's novel is still somewhere out there. her last journal is still somewhere out there. I mean, the word definitive has gotten thrown around so many times with my biography, and I'm very flattered that people use that word to describe it, but there's no such thing as a definitive biography, because there will always be new material. There will always be new questions. There will always be reframings. You know, this is just part of a dialogue that's going to extend
right
outward for years.
Taking that up, I don't want to keep us any further from talking about her as a professional serious writer. And one of the first things that really blew my mind reading this, and I, you know, is evident from the get-go, is how ambitious is a word that I think when we apply it to women is often very loaded. But she was like she didn't waver. Like she knew what she wanted to do, and she set out to do it at such a young age that it's kind of, I mean, I was, it's a little, like, I was a little jealous of that. It's scary, but it's also just like, oh my God, like, yeah, what could I have accomplished if I had gotten my shit together?
You know? Exactly. She's intimidating in that way.
And, you know, after I read it, I listened to some recordings of her reading her poems, and I was just thinking, like, oh my God, this woman would have intimidated the hell out of me at, like, some, you know, at Let Smith or whatever. I would have been like, oh my God. What about that interested you? You know, there's been, or a few reviews I've met of the book have taken a point to specifically mention how much of the kind of juvenilia you get into, whether it's kind of that, the detail of her young life, but then also the work that she was writing at a young age, you quote and talk about really freely. What about that do you think kind of added to the story that you were telling?
Well, the story that I wanted to tell about Sylvia Plath was, and the question, the very simple question that I had in my head was, how did Sylvia Plath become the writer that she became? And that was just the question that guided the whole book, really. If you're going to answer that question in a thorough way, you need to look at her juvenilia, because that's where it all starts. And I felt like so many of the previous biographies, this was an area they had really ignored, I mean, almost completely. And I felt like it was an opportunity for me to tell more of the story and fill in more of the gaps, and also drive home this point that, you know, she had been writing poetry since she was 5 years old. You know, she published her first poem when she was 8. She started writing a novel called Stardust when she was 9. She was constantly writing, and the story of Sylvia Plath becoming a great writer was the story that I wanted to tell, because I thought it was the story that she told about herself most compellingly in her own words, in her journals, and in her letters. How do I become a great writer? And the challenges of that, the joys and the agonies. So anyway, the juvenilia was a big part of that story, because it let me kind of understand how, I guess, the sorts of themes she was interested in as a child and an adolescent, that they sort of foreshadowed for me a lot of her later poetic themes, the kinds of things you images and themes you see in her mature poems. So for me, it was like this archaeology of the manuscripts, because I think that when she went to Smith, she started writing much more mannered poems that were then in style. But if you look at her juvenilia, you can see that other Sylvia Plath was always there, and she was kind of waiting in the wings to reemerge once she got to Cambridge. And I mean, I'm simplifying things quite a bit, but it just gives us a sense that she was always writing poetry and always kind of determined not just to write it, but to publish it. Even as a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, you know, she entered every single contest it was possible to enter. She sent out over 50 poems and short stories in high school and before she got published in 17. And she put them all up on her wall and said, "This is evidence that I'm a writer. You know, my rejections are the evidence of that." Like, she was pretty stoic about her rejections. For a writer who's often, you know, this cliche of emotion or melodrama, I mean, she was just so stoic about her rejections.
Yeah, she seemed to have, you know, and I'm thinking too, especially of when she starts kind of, she kind of puts herself in charge of Ted Hughes' publication.
Yes.
She really has a sharp sense of the business of publishing and is not precious about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, she was his secretary / agent. I don't know if he ever would have become a famous poet if not for her.
Right, right.
And he sort of acknowledged that,
yeah,
a few times as well. She made his career, I think, no doubt about it, sending his work off to various magazines, various contests. I mean, the reason The Hawk and the Rain was published in 1957 was because she sent it out to the contest.
Right.
So, yeah, she was scouring the landscape for these opportunities for him. But what's sort of sad about it is that she chose his manuscript over her own manuscript to send out to that contest.
Yeah.
And then when he wins, she writes things in her journal like, well, when my book wins a prize, we're going to go celebrate with champagne. And, you know, she's happy for him, but she's a bit jealous.
Right.
I don't know if jealous is the right word, but she's a bit sad for herself, I think.
Right. I wonder if you feel like you got a sense of, you know, she is obviously the subject of a lot of kind of feminist takes, but like she still is a woman of the time that she was in. And I wonder how much you got the sense that she made peace with that or like really fought against it.
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, just this question of to what extent she was a proto-feminist, right? Because she died a week before The Feminine Mystique was published.
Mm.
1 week. And so she missed out on everything that the women's movement had to offer. And that's, I think, one of the tragedies of the timing of her death. And you can argue that in some senses, she's not a kind of feminist with a capital F in the way that we think of feminism in 2021. Like she, you know, she was very cruel about women who didn't have children. She could be cruel about women who had abortions. She called her female professors at Newnham grotesques.
Right.
You know, but on the other hand, and I still think of her as a proto-feminist. I mean, even though she took on the bulk of the housekeeping and the child rearing, and she did that willingly, and she did that you know, she was excited to do that, but I still think she believed in equality of opportunity, right? And that's the basic feminist principle. And she was totally angered. She was furious about the sexual double standard. And that's all over her journals, that men could just go out and fulfill their lusts and she couldn't, you know?
Right.
And that just angered her so much. And also she was always putting herself out there, just in terms, she never apologized for her ambition. Sometimes people were just shocked by that, and she could rub people the wrong way and seem too self-involved, and because she was always writing, always determined to be published. But I mean, I think of that as kind of that's feminist, and just writing, just taking the time for herself to write when she had a husband and two children, and she lived in a society that encouraged women to make themselves small, you know, didn't a society that completely dismissed female creative ambition and, you know, encouraged women to stay in the home. I'm talking 1950s America, right? And that just the act of writing itself and sending off poems to the New Yorker and that kind of thing, I think of that as almost like a feminist political act. Now, she was not Adrienne Rich, right? She was not out there running political committees, and I mean, but she died before a lot of that could happen. And Adrienne Rich in the 1950s was very similar to Plath. I mean, she was married to a Harvard economist. She took on the bulk of the housekeeping and the children, and then she said second wave feminism woke her up. Right, she had been sleepwalking, and that was what kind of propelled her into this new life. And Plath never got that chance. And I do wonder if Plath would have had a similar kind of quote-unquote awakening. Would she have kind of followed in Rich's footsteps or not? I just don't know. But it's a question that I've had, if she had lived longer to see the fruits of the women's movement.
It's a really interesting question to think about. And I tend to agree with you. I think it is a feminist act to just kind of claim your space. And one of the things, you know, that I was so in awe of is, you know, she's writing this letter to her mother when she's working on the poems that will be Ariel, and she just says, these poems will make my name. Like, she was just like, I'm gonna be famous, and this is how, and this is, and these are that good. Like, I don't want to say fame for fame's sake, but I was just like, if I could just bottle that, like, just like, there's something just so, I mean, it's completely tragic on the one hand, you know, because you just think, God, what else could she have done? I kind of came to this just out of an enjoyment of creative women biographies. And part of why is I think that it just, like, it's just more and more instruction on, like, here's how you could carry yourself as a woman artist. And I think that, you know, for me, just like growing up, you know, that was not modeled around me. And so I think, like, when I first, in my 30s, when I first went to an artist residency, was the first time I saw sort of middle-aged artist women and just thought, like, oh, this is what my future could look like. And so I kind of approach biographies always with that kind of question, like, how are they doing it? I really admired that in her, even though, of course, like any quality, it can go to an extreme, it can be both bad and good, but just that ability to take yourself seriously when the whole world is telling you not to take yourself seriously. I mean, the fortitude of that is really like something to respect.
Yeah. And that was almost the thing that surprised me the most writing this biography, was just her strength. And her, just that unapologetic, these poems will make my name. And I kind of, that was what I wanted everyone to see that, and just to understand how difficult it was for women at that time to break free, to break out of those gendered roles and kind of, yeah, I mean, to take herself seriously as an artist when no one else would. And I think almost posthumously, right, we didn't really take Sylvia Plath seriously as an artist. And that's what made me so angry, because it was almost like this was happening all over again.
Right, right.
And that she, in my prologue, I quote Adlai Stevenson, and he was the presidential candidate. He was a Democrat, and he gave the commencement speech at Smith in 1955, and he told all of these women that they should aspire to be, quote, humble housewives with a baby in one hand and a can opener in the other. I was so astonished by that, and that he was the liberal darling of his day, and that all of these women applauded. I mean, there were no boos, there were no protests.
Yep.
And that's what you're hearing at your graduation? That's the world that you're being catapulted into. What kind of amazing strength does it take to get past that, to take yourself seriously as an artist? I mean, I have so much respect for her and as an artist in that sense. Yeah.
Just to elaborate on that, I'm just looking at this page of the prologue, and Stevenson also says, once they wrote poetry, now it's the laundry list. They had hoped to play their part in the crisis of the age, but what they do is wash diapers. And then you write, he hoped this view was not, quote unquote, too depressing, but concluded that, quote, women never had it so good as you do.
That's your graduation speech. And so what kind of a message does that send about the trajectory of the rest of your life? And the fact that Plath just, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm sure she applauded kind of faintly, but she was going to have it all. I mean, this is the thing about Plath's feminism this is also why I think of her as a proto-feminist, because she didn't actually sneer at that. In a sense, she wanted the baby, she wanted to make the gourmet dinners, and so she did. She wanted it all before that became a feminist catchphrase. She did not subscribe to the idea that was very prevalent in the 1950s that women had to give up a career for a family, right? She just thought that was complete bullshit.
And to Ted Hughes's credit, he didn't believe that either.
Yeah, he didn't believe that either. Yeah, no, he knew she was a genius. And I mean, you know, we could talk about the ways in which Ted Hughes was not a good husband, especially at the end. But in the beginning, in the first few years of their marriage, he really, I think he really supported her, and I think he knew she maybe had more potential even. He
right,
did
right.
At a certain point.
Right.
But he did. He took the baby in the morning for 4 or 5 hours a day. They switched. So he would watch the baby in the morning, and she would do it in the afternoon and that sort of thing. It all kind of fell apart when they had their second child, because I think, you know, it was just a lot of work, and that writing dynamic was harder to sustain, you know, both of them each having their 5 hours a day, because there was just more work to do. But in the beginning, I think it was fairly idyllic for a few years.
Can you talk a little bit about just, you know, as you're doing the research, watching her kind of hone her voice and her style? That was also part of what I found so fascinating, looking at what she was writing from such a young age. And then, you know, I think it's really easy for us to look at artists who come to have a very strong stylistic stamp as like, oh, this just emerged, like this is just who they are without even trying. But and I think that absolutely that it's in there, like I think it is maybe like a work of excavation, but something was excavated, it feels like. Did you feel like you were watching a shift happen, you know, as you're looking at, because as you said, she was prolific. She took her craft so seriously, and just as the years went on, like what jumped out at you kind of seeing her work change and maybe improve? I don't know, qualitative maybe isn't the right term for it, but you know, seeing her work evolve.
That it was fascinating for me. I mean, I had been well aware of the kind of standard line, the standard critical line on Plath that she had a poetic breakthrough in 1959 at Yaddo, right? That was when kind of aerial voice started to emerge from this chrysalis. And I think there is some truth to that. But again, going back to the juvenilia, you see so many images that she goes back to in her aerial poems. And it's quite astonishing to see that this was always there. And she wrote such beautiful landscape poems as an adolescent. And I always thought that those poems were about emotional truths, you know, but they were filtered through landscapes, you know, moons and trees and storms and this sort of thing. And you see a lot of that again in her later poems, moons and tree, the moon in the yew tree, elm, edge, a lot of these almost talismanic images reappear, but the voice is so much more controlled by the time she writes the aerial poems. And the voice is, it just has an authority that she didn't have maybe earlier. And so to watch her voice kind of take on, I think that tone of authority and kind of absolute belief in itself, the steadfastness, that was sort of thrilling, yeah, to go through the manuscripts like in a kind of archaeological way and kind of watch that progression. But the thing I wanted to also kind of challenge this dominant narrative of Plath the Confessionalist. But I do think she is a quote-unquote confessional poet in some ways, absolutely. But I think that label put her in a box, and she's so much more than that. You know, she is a surrealist of the highest order, in a sense. She was so inspired by surrealist art. So many of these poems that are taught and read as quote-unquote confessional are just full of literary allusions to other authors. And you don't necessarily realize it. And the example that I give in my book is Edge, her late poem Edge, which is probably the last poem she wrote. She wrote it in February 1963, a few days before her suicide, about a week before her suicide. And it's often read as a posthumous suicide note. And in my book, I say, okay, yes, it seems like Plath is writing about her own suicide, and it seems very confessional, but in fact, she's riffing off poems by Yeats, by Sarah Teasdale, by D.H. Lawrence, by William Shakespeare, and you can go into the lines and just like pull out these literary allusions, and it just complicates that idea that she's just writing this cri de coeur, you know, this impulsive... straight from the heart confession. And so I just wanted to challenge that a bit.
No, absolutely. And I think like the idea that these voices aren't controlled, you know, like this is an affectation that they, the authors, are very aware of.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the bell jar is a great example of that too, because again, it almost seems like a Romana Clefs, but again, there are so many literary allusions in that novel to James Joyce, to T.S. Eliot, to D.H. Lawrence. I think the novel is an ironic working of James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist and the Young Man. And it's a very political novel. It's about the Cold War. The first sentence mentions the execution of the Rosenbergs. I mean, this is like This is such a political novel. The politics are hiding in plain sight. But it's so often taught as a breakdown novel or a recovery narrative, and which it is those things, but it's more than that, right? So I just want to expand our notions of what, you know, a Sylvia Plath novel is, or what a Sylvia Plath poem is. I don't want to tell people, oh, she's absolutely not that, right? But she's more.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because there's nothing wrong with being confessional.
Yeah,
It's just there's something wrong with talking about it reductively.
Exactly. And I think that the confessional label can be particularly dangerous for women writers with mental illness, especially Plath and Anne Sexton, because I think it kind of emphasizes the pathology. And it's hard to untangle all of it, because it all sort of started in Robert Lowell's classroom. Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton were Robert Lowell's students in 1959. And that seminar in Boston was sort of, you know, often cited as the kind of birthplace of confessional poetry. And Lowell had been in mental institutions, and Lowell had suffered from breakdowns. And he was very courageous to write about those things at a time when that was considered taboo. And Plath and Sexton, in a way, I think he gave them permission to write about their own experiences with mental illness. So I don't want to say that is in any way, you know, something that we shouldn't applaud in their work. But again, the confessional label, if it's, it can be reductive. It can limit the way that we approach the poems.
Right.
That's all
right.
I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Another thing that I was really curious about, kind of on the flip side of, you know, watching, kind of looking at the kind of whole continuum of her work, is just purely the experience of seeing drafts that are unpublished or unfinished, which feels just like such an intensely private creative moment. And I'm just really curious about, like, there is, I mean, you know, obviously all of this is, as you say, archaeology. I think that's a really good term for it. But there's something that's like slightly more voyeuristic about like the unfinished pieces. So I'm just curious about like the experience, your experience of just engaging with that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain poems that still haven't been published. I mean, most of her juvenilia has not been published. I think that's going to change. Currently, there is a new edition of Plath's poems, which is being edited by two phenomenal Plath scholars, Karen Kukiel and Amanda Golden. So that will come out in a few years, and that will contain a lot more of these unpublished poems. So everyone should be very excited about that. But yeah, I think that some of the poems, for me, there was one called I Am an American. And that was such a political poem. She writes, I think she wrote it in 1952. So again, right in the height of the McCarthy witch hunt and Cold War. And she takes America to task. You know, she says something like, we all live by the Bendix, the Buick, and the batting average. And she talks about xenophobia and American consumerism in this poem. And so, you know, I think that was a finished poem. It wasn't unfinished, but it just never made its way into a collection. So there were poems like that I would read. And I thought, wait a minute, this isn't, I've never seen this before. And there was another one called, I think it was called Home Thoughts from Abroad. And it was written from a young woman's perspective in London, a young mother who was just out walking her baby. And she the speaker reminisces and misses America very much in that poem, and kind of thinks about home and exile and all these really complicated emotions. And that was also never published. And so it just presented, I think, a different side of Plath that most of us don't get to see. So I'm really excited that poems like that will be featured in the new edition.
Yeah, that's definitely very exciting news. And I would love to talk a little bit about your process with, I mean, frankly, just logistically somewhat as well.
Yeah.
You know, but also just when, you know, well, let's start at a point instead of me just talking. Do you write and research simultaneously, or do you feel like you do, there's a research phase and then you reach a point where you're like, okay, I'm ready?
Yeah, it's sort of hard to know, because for this biography, I felt like I already had done so much research because I had written a book on Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes and their poetic relationship. So I had this critical foundation. I'd already spent, 5 years reading all the Plath and Hughes scholarship. So I did write as I researched in this book. I did, and I started at the beginning. I didn't do any fancy chronological footwork. The first chapter was the genealogy, and I wanted to take a chronological approach because I just felt like that would be the best way for me to understand how she grew as a person and as a writer. For this next book I'm working on, I'm doing more research. I'm kind of dividing up the research and the writing more. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But I know a lot of people they really don't enjoy writing as they research, but that was absolutely my method when I was writing Red Comet.
Right.
I would write something every day. It would be very rare that I would just spend a day reading stuff, I would always try to get something on the page, even if the next day I erased it all. But it just helped me keep my momentum to have this feeling of okay, today I wrote something.
right.
Just kind of keeping myself going a little bit.
And I assume that you had a pretty good sense at the outset that it would be a lengthy book.
I did. I thought it would be 500 to 600 pages. And it was double that. I cut 300 pages myself before I even sent it to my editor in January of 2020. And then she helped me cut more. But I don't know what happened, really. I mean, there was a certain point where I just stopped looking at the word count because it would just fill me with anxiety and shame.
You were ashamed of writing so much?
Yes. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I just kept, it made me so anxious and worried, because I knew I was writing a much longer book than my contract called for, and I was afraid they were going to make me cut it in half. And the last few years were a lot of anxiety. But on the other hand, I just felt like once you start writing in a granular way, it's really hard to change that. And I guess I just took this stance of, well, nobody has gone into this much detail about her ever. And we don't have the big biography. And this is my contribution, this mm-hmm. is,
yeah.
And I love short biographies. There's nothing wrong with a 200 page biography. But I just, that was missing for Plath. And I just decided, this is what I'm going to do. Go big or go home, So.
How do you keep yourself organized? How do you keep the documents and the research and your drafts organized?
Yeah, I spent a long time just taking photos at all of these archives at the very beginning of the project. So, I went to the Lilly Library in Indiana, which has probably most of her material. Lilly and Smith have the most, but I would just stand there 8 hours a day with a camera, click, 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 I'd have wrist cramps at the end of the day. So I would take everything home to my study. Of course, I wanted to read these documents in the archive. I wanted so badly to just sit down but I knew that I didn't have the time to do that because I had two small children at home, and going to archives is expensive, and arranging childcare is difficult. And so I just didn't have the luxury of being able to sit in an archive for 6 months, which I did before I had kids. Like, before I had kids, I could just, I could spend hours, but it just, the equation changed, right, when you have kids at home. So, but I just, everything was on iPhoto, and I just kind of, nothing fancy, just organized all the letters into chronological sections and manuscripts and documents. I mean, I basically copied the archive's own categories. So I would just read through the original letters on my computer as I was trying to write. And so many of them had not been published at that point. I mean, now all of Sylvia Plath's surviving letters were published in 2018. But I started this in 2011.
Did you have any struggles with, you know, we talked about Sylvia Plath herself kind of being able to claim her own authority. Like, was claiming authority over this narrative something that you struggled with?
No, I don't. That is not something that I struggled with, strangely.
That's wonderful.
Because, yeah, no, I think because I was just, it came from a place of anger initially, this whole project, because I was angry about the way she'd been pathologized, and I felt it was sexist. And so that was kind of just this fire that propelled me. And it was sort of this mission. It was mission driven in that sense. I guess I didn't have those kinds of struggles. People ask me, like, oh, did you dream about Sylvia Plath all the time? And how did you separate your life from hers? And I actually did not have that problem either. I think I was just so busy trying to, you know, I'm a professor as well, trying to maintain my academic life and my students and my children. And it was just like, I didn't have time to ruminate. You know, once the kids came home from school, it was like, okay,
right.
Dinner, bath time. In a way that saved me, because it was such a huge distraction from a really emotionally difficult subject that I was immersed in for 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
But that's kind of one of the wonderful things about parenthood, right?
Yeah. No.
A blessing and a curse, right?
I think it's very much a working writer kind of mentality.
Yes,
and
yes.
And
you turn it off,
right? Yeah. And I don't have kids, but I do have a day job, and sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm so in this world in the morning when I'm writing, and then I don't think about it for the rest of the day. And sometimes that feels very strange, but I like your take on it too, that there is this sort of, we always need distance from the thing.
We do. And especially something that's really a tragic story on many levels.
Of course.
Yeah. And I tried to kind of protect myself in a way from just, you know, becoming too emotionally invested and paralyzed in a sense by the tragedy of the story.
Can you talk a little bit about what you're working on now? I know it's also involves Plath, right, and several other writers.
Yes, I am about 100 pages into a group biography of Plath, Ann Sexton, Adrienne Rich, and Maxine Cumin in Boston in the 1950s and 60s. And so they all knew each other, some more than others, but the book is about kind of their struggles and their story as they tried to become great writers, great poets in Boston in the 50s, and this, again, in this world that wanted them to be mothers and housewives, and kind of how they inspired each other.
Well, I will eat that up for sure.
I'm going to stick to my word limit this time. So this will be a 300 page book. I am determined to stick to my poor editor. I mean, God love her.
I was really curious. This came up on the Working podcast, and I thought it was such a smart question, because I also had an answer to this. But you were asked, you know, what, or I'm not even sure if he asked you. I can't remember what you said. So maybe I'm misremembering this already. But the idea of, like, just this one detail that stuck out, and for Rumen Alam, it was the cherries and the peach and the cherries and the grapes that she's eating at the beach. And I very much have a detail that stood out for me, and I'll tell you, but first I want to know if there's a detail that really kind of stands furthest out for you.
You know, I think it might have been the cherries on the beach too, but there's partly, I'm from Cape Cod. I love to be on Cape Cod. I spend as much time as possible there. So all of those beach scenes when she was on the Cape, I'm on Cape Cod right now. The beach scenes really affected me because I just have been to those beaches. And when she had the cherries and she was opening the magazine and reading her story by herself on the beach with, you know, with her fruit and just having this moment of pure, you know, unapologetic admiration for her achievement. Like, I just loved that whole scene.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful image. Mine was, I want to preface, you know, we've talked a lot about not reducing, and so I don't want to, this is a semi-dramatic detail, so I don't want to take it, I'm not by any means saying this is the only thing I took out of this book, but I was so mesmerized by this visual, this mental image of her knocking on her neighbor's door. This is towards the end of her life. And he answers and they chat about something and he goes back inside. And then like 20 minutes later, he opens the door again and she's just still standing in the hallway. And I was just like, I'm going to steal that at some point and you'll just know that that's where I got it. But like, I was just like, that's like, I mean, haunting feels like such a cheap word for it, but it just really was so stirring to me. And so there's so much emotional resonance there that there are so many layers there, I think, to that.
Yeah, that, no, I know exactly. I feel the same way about that moment and what was she thinking and what was happening. And then that, I think those final maybe two or three chapters, I used a lot more white space between paragraphs. Mm. Because I just felt like I needed, it was so intense. I needed to give them space to kind of process the things that were happening. And so, yeah, you'll notice that there is more white space between paragraphs in those last couple chapters and more section breaks and things like that.
Yeah, you're right. I'm flipping through it right now. That's wonderful. That's really, really smart.
And it kind of happened that way, but I think I also needed to sort of set it down, and then I don't know, but
yeah. Well, I want to wrap up our convo with a question that I always like to ask everybody at the end of our conversations, which is, what does creative satisfaction look like for you right now?
I feel really good about Red Comet. That is creative satisfaction for me. I feel like it's achieved what I wanted it to achieve, which is to enlarge people's perception about Sylvia Plath, change their sense of who she was. She wasn't just this writer who wrote poems about death and suicide. She's one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, and I think she changed English poetry. She changed style and substance. And if we're taking Sylvia Plath more seriously, then that's deeply satisfying for me as a literary critic and biographer. So yeah, I'm creatively satisfied at the moment. In a year or so, I'll really want to start finish my next book. But right now, I'm good.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. It was a pleasure to talk to you. It was a pleasure to read this book. And I'm really excited for what you're working on next.
Great, thank you. And I should add that Red Comet comes out in paperback on September 24th. It will be more affordable, but still pretty heavy.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at WMFApodcast.com. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review on iTunes to help new listeners find the show. Have a question or author recommendation? Email me at hello@WMFApodcast.com. Find me on Twitter and Instagram at CF Ballastier, or leave a voicemail at 347-685-4836. The WMFA logo was created by Unsold Studio, and our theme music is Jazz Dancer by Double Winter. Find them at doublewinter.bandcamp.com. WMFA is part of the Lit Hub Radio Network and is made in Pittsburgh by Courtney Ballastier, LLC. All rights reserved.